Any instance of change is usually just one point on a much longer journey. But how does change happen? Whether it's public opinion, legislation, our behaviour, our communities, or just one person's life? That's our question. This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. In 2013, a major piece of legislation was passed by the British Parliament. It legalised marriage for same-sex couples in England and Wales, and was the result of several decades of activism. To discuss just how it happened, we assembled three of the most important players in that groundbreaking campaign. Of course, the actors in any significant social change are themselves on a journey. Even natural allies will have different approaches to the same problem and different ideas about the end game. So to discuss the story of the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act 2013, we're joined by Peter Tatchell, who's been campaigning since 1967, during which time he called out homophobia, hypocrisy and human rights abuses. He coordinated the Equal Love campaign, which played a key role in passing the legislation. Benjamin Cohen is an entrepreneur and a journalist. He's the founder of Pink News and is currently the chief exec and editor-in-chief. And Liz Barker, a Lib Dem life peer, she's an advocate on many LGBTI issues and made the decision to come out publicly during the House of Lords debate on the bill.
To put this in context, last year in Parliament we celebrated the 50th anniversary of partial decriminalisation. Parliament went a bit Judean and Sandy at one point. I mean, there were so many gay events going on celebrating this thing. Over the course of those 50 years, gay people went from being feared outsiders about whom most people knew nothing to being people who people began to know as individuals and within their family. And I think it's just worth just running through a few dates for this. 1988, Section 28 was passed. 2000, the ban on serving in the military was overturned. 2001, we got equal age of consent. 2002, we got same-sex couples being allowed to adopt children. And I personally think that that was probably one of the most significant changes that we had in the law, because it finally put to rest the idea that gay people were not safe to be around in charge of children, and that actually we had families. That, I think, was a really important point. Then through to 2006, the Equality Act. So at every stage, we had to battle the evangelical Christian right. And way back at the beginning, it was an absolute battle, particularly in the House of Lords. That felt like a real, real battle against them. We saw the Conservatives trying desperately to decontaminate their brand from Section 28 and all the stuff in the past. But at the same time, we saw the rise of UKIP. And I heard, you know, UKIP's policies on LGBT thing are quite frightening, frankly. So I think all of that led up to the point where we had civil partnership. We knew within the community that it was okay, but it still felt like second best.
Ben Cohen.
I was in California for the elections in 2008, which saw Barack Obama get elected, but also California voting for Prop 8. Which banned same-sex marriage in California, having had it just introduced by the Supreme Court of California. I was at a LGBT Democrats party as the results came in that Obama has won, and then county after county voted against gay people having the rights to marry. The next day I was in Sacramento, the capital of California, at this amazing vigil with some couples who had got married. And you know, were going to be allowed to stay married, but other people who probably wouldn't be able to get married. But it sort of struck me that I was standing there watching people who were upset about something, losing something that we weren't even campaigning for. And so when I got back from California, I sat down with Jess, who was my employee then, and said, look, this is kind of ridiculous, what should we do? This was now 2009, we're coming up to the 2010 general election. We had arranged to do Q&As of all of the party leaders ahead of the general election. Nick Clegg was first in the February of that year, and he was asked by readers, do you support same-sex marriage? And he said, yeah, I believe it, whether you're gay or straight, you should be able to get married. Then we had David Cameron. David Cameron wasn't quite as strong, but said he was open to considering it. And on the same day that we published David Cameron's response, Theresa May, as the Shadow Equalities Minister back then, authored a Conservatives Contract for Equalities, which committed the Conservatives, if they were in government, to have a public consultation. It said the wording then was to redefine civil partnerships as civil marriage. The day before the election, we finally got Gordon Brown, and he said civil partnerships are enough. He accurately predicted that it would cause an argument with the church and people like that, and you know, the coalition was formed. And you know, there was a Labour leadership election, and we did the same thing. We asked all the candidates, and Ed Miliband said that he supported it. It was then really clear that you had the leadership of all three parties, you know, either open to exploring this or 100% committed to it. And I think it was really important that it came from them. It meant there was political leadership and political capital given. When Nick Clegg and David Cameron, you know, committed the coalition to going through the consultation process, they expended a huge amount of political capital. Cameron went to war with his own backbenchers over this issue. But it was really important that they made that decision.
Peter Tatchell.
Well, perhaps I'd like to start by saying that it's very important to remember that the battle for marriage equality was originally in the 1960s begun by trans women. These are trans women who had managed to get married under the 1949 Act, and it was only later that their marriages were challenged, or in one case, where they were seeking a divorce and a settlement. The most notable campaign, of course, was April Ashley, and her case made headlines in Britain and around the world. But she and a couple of other trans women were the first to really challenge the presumption that same-sex couples could not be married. And I say presumption because, of course, the 1949 Marriage Act did not stipulate that marriage partners have to be male and female. And sadly, the backlash against April Ashley and the other trans women was that the government in 1971 passed the Nullity of Marriage Act, which for the first time in British history explicitly prohibited same-sex marriage. And that was later transferred into the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1973. The next, I suppose, big challenge was in 1992, when the LGBT Direct Action Group, Outrage, organised five of its same-sex couples to file applications for civil marriage at Westminster Register Office in Marylebone Road. I can remember them going in and demanding a marriage licence and being told by the registrar that you can't have one, it's prohibited. And they said, well, here's a copy of the 1949 Marriage Act. Where does it say that marriage partners have to be male and female? And I can remember the deep intake of breath of the marriage registrar, who went to this panic mode. She went away for about 40 minutes. She obviously phoned the Home Office or somewhere and then was told about the Matrimonial Causes Act and the prohibition that was enshrined there. So those couples were refused, but that really kickstarted the whole public awareness about same-sex marriage or the lack of it. Then Roe Forward, Outrage kept on campaigning about this on and off, but the big next significant move was the formation of the Equal Love Campaign in 2010, which sought to overturn both the ban on same-sex marriage and the ban on opposite-sex civil partnerships. So it was a coalition to support straight people who were denied the right to a civil partnership, as well as LGBT people who were denied a civil marriage. And it was Outrage with a coalition of other LGBT groups, some non-LGBT groups, civil rights groups, and a cross-party group of MPs and peers and MEPs as well. The first major thing we did was we got together eight couples, four same-sex couples and four opposite-sex couples, who went respectively to their local register offices to file applications. The opposite-sex couples filed an application for a civil partnership. The same-sex couples filed an application for a civil marriage. They were all refused. At their insistence, they were given letters of refusal. And then, with the help of Professor Robert Wintermute at King's College, we filed a joint application in the European Court of Human Rights to overturn the twin bans there. Then we went to David Cameron and the Conservatives and said, wouldn't it be much better, rather than you get slapped down by the European Court, wouldn't it be much better if you took the initiative to legislate marriage equality and to end the ban on opposite-sex civil partnerships? Isn't that much better? You don't want to be told by Europe to do it, because that will just play into the hands of UKIP and all the Eurosceptics, apart from anything else. We actually told them, this is a way you can detoxify the Tory brand. You can make yourself look liberal and undermine the nasty party image you've had by championing this cause. So David Cameron's advisors went away to think about it. In the meantime, I went around the country ambushing Tory MPs to get them on the record that they would support marriage equality. So, for example, I went to Norwich Pride, and Chloe Smith, the Tory MP, was on the panel, and I got someone to ask her a question, would she support equal marriage? And she ummed and ahed, but eventually said yes. That same year, Boris Johnson was elected Mayor of London, and he decided to head the Pride March that year. So when he was completely surrounded by all the world's media, I crawled between his legs and thanked him for coming and said, we're really glad you're here. Will you be supporting same-sex marriage? Will you support the ending of the ban on same-sex marriage? And you can imagine Boris is huffing and puffing. But eventually he said yes. And that was on record. And then the following Monday, by chance, I was invited to a reception at City Hall for influential Londoners, and Boris made his big speech, and at the end of it he curiously said, well, I think I've said enough, if no one else has anything else to say. So I piped up and actually jumped on the stage and said, Boris, on behalf of everyone here, we want to thank you for expressing your support for same-sex marriage. So once Boris Johnson had said yes, that made it so much easier to get loads of other Tory MPs. So that's what we did. We went around individually MPs. We said, look, Chloe Smith's backing it. Boris Johnson's supporting it. Margot James is supporting it. Will you add your name? And then we got quite a big coalition of Tory MPs. And then, of course, we fed that back to Downing Street. Your own MPs, even your own Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, is backing this. The second phase was to pitch it to Conservatives that marriage is a Conservative value, that Conservatives believe in loving, long-term, stable relationships, and that therefore it's because you're a Conservative that you should be supporting this. And I'll never forget, I was absolutely blown down when David Cameron did his speech at Tory Party conference, where he mirrored almost exactly the words that we'd been feeding his people, that he was supporting marriage precisely because he was a Conservative.
Not in spite of being Conservative.
Yeah, not in spite of being Conservative. Yeah, not in spite of being Conservative, because he was a Conservative.
The whole thing that was led by, in Parliament, by Waheed, to allow those faith groups which wanted to conduct civil partnerships in religious premises. Now, I freely admit that I thought that was tactically wrong. I thought, right, we'll never get, you know, if we don't hold out for marriage, you know, we'll never get it. And I mean, clearly I didn't oppose it. I kept very quiet about it, but I really didn't think that was right. I was wrong about that. I was wrong for two reasons. One, it enabled those faith groups to whom that was important to make that argument visible. Because we had put in that legislation that this was an entirely permissible thing for religions, and that those religions which did not wish to do it were not going to be compelled to do it. That was a key thing, and that allowed the liberal Jews, the Quakers, they all came in and they did that, and that was, I think, really important.
Pink News would give a platform to some of the things that Equal Love was doing, but it wasn't what we were doing. So we facilitated the Out for Marriage campaign. We worked it. So for that, I should have actually said, as I didn't say in the preamble, how that even started. It started because I went to Number 10, just like in the heat of all of the negative newspaper coverage, and kind of sat down with a special advisor who said, look, there's no positive campaign. There's nothing. It's all just like these bishops and people saying, the world's going to end. What could we do? And it's like, on my way back on the tube, I kind of thought, well, why don't we just get ordinary people and celebrities to say why they would want to change the law? And we released the videos sort of day after day, so that each day there would be a new story, whether it was Theresa May records one, or it was Hugh Grant. And we, you know, some of that stuff was done in conjunction with people. So we did this really fun one with Nick Clegg's team. He had loads of gay people working for him at that period. Mm-hmm. And we'd kind of arranged this kind of, there was this party where it was like in favour of same-sex marriage, but they would get celebrities there, and it was set up in a very nice way. So people walked in the door. It was in some Foreign Office building. Clegg was upstairs, but before you got upstairs, there was a cloakroom on one side, but there was also me and a camera crew on the other side. And we basically kind of prevented people going up, famous people going up the stairs without recording a video. Hugh Grant didn't really come to... He came to lobby about press reform, but he found himself recording a video lobbying to change the law on same-sex marriage, which then went everywhere. It was in newspapers everywhere. It was obviously Four Weddings and a Funeral, and obviously famously not got married. And so you could do things with people, but also these were all happening sort of semi-independently. You know, the parliamentary thing was going on its own course with people leading it there. You had kind of Peter's campaign on one side. We were doing things. Eventually, Stonewall, when they realised that it's going to happen, so they may as well be on the winning side, decided to join. And they did do some good things in Parliament. There was all these different actors playing, but I think it was quite kind of important that people felt... the different groups felt motivated for their own reasons. Because there was this ludicrous thing where you'd get politicians saying, well, I've never met a gay person that wants to get married, never heard from one. Well, we knew that everyone had sent one, and the responses, couldn't do this now because of GDPR, but the responses were copied into us, and I'd got these really amazing emails back from people like Norman Tebbit ranting about why gays couldn't get married. But it was useful content. But also, you knew these people were essentially lying if they said, well, no one's got in touch with me. But it was important for them, all these different things to be done themselves. There wasn't like a kind of secret meeting that all of us who are in favour of it had to be kind of coordinated.
I know, the Christian right always has gone about this big gay conspiracy that was going on. You know, all back through those whole 50 years, we've never had one organisation coordinating everybody. We've had all sorts of different people, and we didn't even have an all-parliamentary group on LGBT issues until way after all of this had happened. So, dead right, it was different people playing to their different strengths and understanding that there are completely different audiences who had to come to this and be taught to in completely different ways. The religious organisations, we had to have a different conversation with them from, the sort of feminist lesbians who believed that marriage was the worst thing that ever happened, so we had to have a completely different conversation over there.
This is Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. We're discussing the passing of the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act 2013. Taking part in this discussion are Lib Dem peer Liz Barker, gay rights activist Peter Tatchell, and founder and editor of Pink News, Benjamin Cohen.
We weren't campaigning for equal civil partnerships at that point, because we're talking about marriage. And, the one thing I should have said before, we haven't finished this journey because we don't have equal marriage across the whole of the United Kingdom. I've had some very interesting conversations with Arlene Foster recently about it. And so I think maybe there could be progress in that if that happens in the future. But, they're all different people had different, slightly different takes on the same thing. If I'm remembering this wrong, you were never a big fan of marriage, personally.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, it's ironic that the most radical queer rights group Outrage was the one that championed same-sex marriage, even though most of our members personally opposed marriage. We shared the feminist critique, our patriarchal, misogynistic, sexist institution. But we said the ban on same-sex couples was homophobic, and therefore we should fight it. And it's not up to us to dictate who can marry and who can't. That's up to the individual. And of course, we wouldn't want to get married. We wouldn't want to deny people who do that right and that option. The other thing I'd say is that in the 1990s, the two main LGBT organisations were Stonewall and Outrage. And we had quite different approaches. Stonewall was very much focused on parliamentary reform, on law reform. And Outrage was also focused on that. But we argued that you have to also win hearts and minds. You have to change public opinion. And that was the rationale for lots of the protests, the visible protests we did, was not the protest itself, but use the protest to put the issue in the news and on the public agenda to raise awareness and provoke debate. So we were very much, had a twin-track approach, law reform plus changing public opinion. And we also, in the sort of about 2010, 2011, 2012 period, lobbied very hard to get opinion polls taken because we were convinced that the public was probably ready for it. And we knew if we could get the evidence, that would, you know, encourage the politicians. So the early polls were showing, well, first of all, the government had its consultation on same-sex marriage, which was, at that time, the biggest ever public consultation, I think with over 200,000 responses, overwhelmingly in favour of same-sex marriage. Overwhelmingly in favour. And also, incidentally, overwhelmingly in favour of equal civil partnerships as well. And then we had further polls, for example, YouGov. We asked them, I think others asked them, but we asked them to ask a specific question about religious people's views. Because as Liz mentioned, organised religion, the religious hierarchies were some of the main oppositionists. And so YouGov asked that question and found that 55% of people of faith supported the right of same-sex couples to marry in civil ceremonies. And that was incredibly powerful to use to rebut what the religious leaders were saying and also to give ammunition to the government.
Liz Barker.
Earlier on this year, I was off in Latvia. I went to Baltic Pride, and I was terribly honoured to go, and it was a real wake-up call to me. Because we did go on the Pride March, we had to be accompanied by heavily armed soldiers, and we got tear gassed. I mean, world away from London Pride, and it was a sobering reminder about how far we've come, but how far other people have got to go. But in the discussion that we were having, with a bunch of the activists up there, it occurred to me about, I mean, what happens? What are the big ingredients about that social change? And I think the first is that you need to have a visionary who begins to talk about what is happening. I mean, in this case, talk about what's happening and what's an injustice. What you also need is some people with the power to change that and to address that injustice, and they're inevitably politicians. And I think the one group of people that we kind of overlook over here are the people who are the advisors to politicians, the people in the background, the civil servants, and diplomats. I was in Pride in Riga. All the diplomats and that were sort of down the front. In fact, what we were was we were the human shield for the people at the back, so that they actually could have their Pride march in peace. And then in the middle, between those two groups of people, you've got, perhaps again, a group of people that we overlook, the allies, the people who say, I'm not from that minority group, but you're oppressing them in my name. Stop doing that. That's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. And you put all those three groups together and talking to each other, doing it in different ways. Sometimes it's out with Peter on the barricades outside. Sometimes it is inside with the civil servants saying, what can we do? The civil servants who worked on same-sex marriage were absolutely brilliant. But one thing that they had was that they had it absolutely fixed in their mind that in the government's eyes, civil partnership and same-sex marriage were of equivalent status, right? There was no way in which same-sex marriage was better. They were equivalent. And we came to a point where there was a bunch of peers having a meeting with the bill team, and they were talking about the process by which you could... it would be possible to change an existing civil partnership into a same-sex marriage. And these poor civil servants sat there and said, well, because there's no value judgment in all of this, all you need to do is send off a form to the registrar and you can change it. And the look of horror on the faces of these gay men, what? No party? No, I don't think so. Thank you very much. These poor civil servants go, you can have a party if you want. You can. Yeah, absolutely. But it was such a funny point at which they had such a technical understanding of what they were doing, and the people whose lives it was going to make a difference to felt completely different about it.
Now, if people don't believe in the construct of marriage, that's totally fine. Some of my friends never want to get married, but equally I never wanted to be in a civil partnership because I do believe in the institution of marriage, and that's why I'm in a marriage. And it's about choice. And what the problem that we had right at the beginning was that arguments that I think are valid arguments that people have about the construct of marriage or whatever, that's fine, but that doesn't mean you can't let other people do it.
The outrage thinking, apart from the fact that we saw the ban on same-sex marriage as being homophobic, and we thought people should have a right to choose, we also saw the marriage issue as, if you like, a wedge by which we can move away from the way in which our opponents and critics were always boiling it down to sex. So we could talk about love, we could talk about commitment. And we felt, Outrage felt, that was a really important, effective way of undermining a lot of what our critics were saying.
There was a point when a whole bunch of... I was talking to a whole bunch of peers and they were asking all these very sort of technical questions about, is it equal marriage? What does it mean? And it wasn't me, it was somebody else who said, look, the important thing about this is it is symbolic. It means that gay people and their families can celebrate within their communities. And that is enormous. And it is, you know, and I talk about, no, it's not about frocks and cakes and, you know, all that kind of, it is absolutely, you know, my gay son got married, my not gay son got married, you all came. And that was the importance of it.
We all ended up being at events and things and then talking about tactics, but there wasn't a formal email chain or something. I think it was better that people weren't coordinating because it allowed for there to be a diversity in approach. So our approach was always about media. You know, we built a partnership with the Evening Standard, so they would publish all of the videos every day and feature it in the paper. But that, it wouldn't have worked, actually, if it was done separately. But as it happens, these two both were in our videos. So there was... Because also you have this annoying thing of, like, committees where you just, like, would spend so long arguing about the parameters of things and not enough time actually doing it. Each individual group there had their own kind of committees or whatever that would do things, but it wouldn't have worked for there to be this, like, gay parliament or whatever, or LGBT parliament kind of trying to work things out. I genuinely think it would have taken way longer to do it.
Yeah, I'd second what Ben said. I think the autonomous, diverse nature of the different groups was a strength, not a weakness. Yeah. And, I mean, his Out for Marriage campaign was absolutely fantastic and was a very, very important contribution to winning in the end. But there were so many other groups that, you know, we haven't got time to go through them all, but so many people, not just LGBT, but also straight and straight organisations that rallied to support us. And I want to pay tribute to all those LGBT people and straight allies who were part of that process, because it was the collectivity and the cumulative effect of all those different diverse campaigns that brought us to the place of marriage equality.
On the term equal marriage, I think it was a deliberate choice. That sound that you heard in early 2013 was the sound of Johnny Oates, who's Nick Clegg's head of staff, banging his head off walls in the morning hall going, not talking about gay marriage, we're not talking about gay marriage. So you can argue the finer point of detail and say that it was technically wrong, but actually it was probably quite important to some people.
So we didn't use it. When we were talking about marriage, and so everything about the Out for Marriage campaign, we didn't call it Out for Equal Marriage. We just called it Out for Marriage because we supported the notion of marriage. And when I got married, I didn't have an equal marriage. I just had a marriage to my husband. And so even on Pink News, we do use equal marriage sometimes within copy. We also use same-sex marriage to distinguish between same-sex and opposite-sex marriage, particularly in countries which are campaigning for same-sex marriage to become legal. But what we weren't, in my view, trans issues aside, and we weren't, the campaign in 2012, 2013 was to allow same-sex couples to marry. There was a separate campaign, which is about making the whole institution of relationship recognition to be equal, which is about civil partnerships, it's about marriage. But specifically, straight people weren't banned from getting married. It was gay people that were banned from getting married. So that it made sense to talk, in some ways, about same-sex marriage, but we made a decision that we would just talk about marriage. We liked marriage, and we wanted to be able to be in the marriage.
Change never really ends. The Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act 2013 was just one step on a never-ending journey of change. Having achieved equal marriage in most of the UK, many people continue to reflect on the institution and ask whether it serves all of us well. With the final word, Peter Tatchell.
We've discussed a lot about how it began, how it succeeded, and how we won marriage equality.
In England.
In England, and Scotland, and Wales, but not in Northern Ireland. But I think what we also need to think about is the marriage and civil partnership model the best one that we could have? So this goes back to the outrage critique of marriage, despite us supporting same-sex marriage. We propose, or I drafted for Outrage, what's become known as a civil commitment pact, which is a completely different framework of relationship recognition. If we were starting from scratch, I don't think we'd choose either marriage or civil partnerships, which are essentially marriage light. I think we'd think about starting from scratch and devising something completely new. So, for example, both civil marriage and civil partnerships discriminate against single people in terms of next of kin status and in terms of inheritance tax breaks. I don't think that's fair or right. So under the Civil Commitment Pact, a person would be allowed to nominate any significant other person in their life, which might be a partner, or if they're single, it might be a lifelong best friend, a favourite niece or nephew, their flatmate, their carer, whatever. But it gives everyone the option of being able to designate who their next of kin should be and who should benefit from the tax breaks that go with inheritance. But the second element of this civil commitment pact is that for in people with a loving, romantic, sort of marriage-type relationship, they should be allowed to pick and mix from a menu of rights and responsibilities. Because with marriage and civil partnerships, it's one size fits all. You just sign on the dotted line. There's no negotiation. There's no options. It doesn't take into account the huge variety of modern lifestyles and relationships. So under, as things stand, some partners live together, some live apart. Some have, they share their finances. Others maintain financial independence. Some have kids, some don't. Under this system, each couple could create a bespoke partnership agreement suited to their particular needs. And that would, I think, be much more democratic, much more flexible, much more modern, much more egalitarian. Couples would have to sit down and go through each individual right and responsibility and sign it off. So it actually, paradoxically, would make couples think much more carefully about what they were getting into. None of this just signed the dotted line with a marriage or a civil partnership certificate. So I'm not pretending for one moment that this idea is the perfect model or anything. I'm sure greater minds than mine will come up with something even better. But I think this is probably the way to go. Probably not the way to go right now, so soon after same-sex marriage. But I think in the near future, I think we do need to think about a different model of relationship recognition and rights, one that is more democratic, flexible, and open to suiting the individual needs of a particular couple.
You've been listening to Social Power, a podcast from the Sheila McKechnie Foundation. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review and share it with a friend or a colleague. We'd particularly like to thank Whistledown for producing this podcast. You can find out more about the Social Change Project at smk.org.uk.